Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond. Are you up for it?
Well, somebody who actually partly inspired this piece was a piano teacher I had when I was a teenager, who was from France but living in Philadelphia, named Bernard Piffer. And he was a jazz pianist, but he was classically trained. So he had this sense of there not being boundaries between the two different genres. So now this is, you know, very commonplace, but at the time, it was just not really talked about. He just played music, you know? He would have me analyze music with jazz cymbals. So I remember showing it to another teacher, and the other teacher thought I was faking it. You know, like Beethoven's Sonata with jazz. But he was very important to me, and the reason why this ties in is he fought with the French Resistance when he was quite young. So I always had this idea to write a piece inspired by the French Resistance. But he died when I was quite young, and he was this very important teacher to me. This new piece is completely scored because it's for a group that, you know, that's what they do. They read music and they're very good, and they play a lot, you know, different kinds of music. But this piece has wound up being a very strange combination because it's for a telesinfonietta that's 8 musicians and a conductor, Pierre-André Vallade, and my own trio, which is myself on sampler, Roger Clair on electric guitar, and Chris Cutler, who's an English drummer. And our part, none of it is scored. It's improvised, but I mean, it's very structured, but it's more in terms of texture. So different sounds happen in different areas, and that part is controlled. And my part actually is notated because of the samples. I have to remember which notes to hit to trigger the right sample, but it is a very odd combination of the two. And we've kind of drawn the ensemble into some of the freer parts, so they're playing more improvised music as well, which is probably a little bit outside their experience. It's just finding the best language for somebody to express themselves, you know. So not necessarily so the musician is the most comfortable, but so the musician can work at their best advantage, you know, so I can get the best performance out of them. Again, one of the pieces on this program is EWA7, which is just for my band, and it's this big noisy piece, so it's very funny to have spent 4 hours rehearsing with the Sinfonietta and then just like sit down and play with a rock band. It's kind of a nice way to blow off steam. But for me, the music is very interconnected. The most extreme contrast, I'd say, is there's a CD that has the piece EWA7, which is inspired by factory sounds. It was composed at this factory in Germany where I had a residency one summer in Nuremberg. And then when I came home, I wanted to write a piece that was notated that could be played all over the world. I mean, one of the drawbacks of working so much with the sampler is it means that I can play it or somebody else can play it if it's notated, and if they can reach me and get a hold of all of the equipment you need to perform a piece. So sometimes for me, it's much better to have a piece that's traditionally notated, because then I just send somebody score and parts and they can play it anywhere in the world. We just did a gig recently in New York. I mean, I think if you're an improviser, you're just an improviser. And I think it's an important way to keep your mind open. And it probably makes you a different kind of composer. I'm not fast. I'm not really prolific. It takes me a long time to finish a piece, and I'll labor over it for a long time. But there's something about that initial process of being an improviser where you can be less analytical about what you're doing, and you might have a much broader set of choices available to you. I think it's because I listened to so many different kinds of music, and I was raised in a household with a lot of music, but not a lot of classical music. So there's a lot of rhythm and a lot of drums. Just because my parents and my older siblings listened to a lot of jazz, a lot of rock, a lot of R&B, a lot of blues. And it, you know, you absorb it. I think you just absorb everything you hear. So I couldn't strip those ideas out of what I liked in music. So I think it's just part of who I am. And I think playing in bands made a difference too. And percussionists are really like developing now. I think the idea of percussion in classical music has really expanded. It used to be if you wrote a part for drums, you didn't always get a good performance, but that has changed. If you're a trained pianist, you sit down and you know where the notes are going to come out. You can memorize a piece, and you'll have some physical sense of where the pitch is, and it helps you remember where to put your fingers. A lot of the samples come on funny places, so it's funny, it's much harder to memorize these pieces, and if you play with some kind of cliched Chopin-esque flourish, it's going to sound totally strange, which is kind of fun and new, but I did a lot of work, as you said, with prepared piano sounds and detuned piano sounds, and that the interpretation of the performance was always kind of interesting because of that. Well, this piece, a lot of it is inspired by radio transmissions that were made to resistance groups from England, you know, from the SOE in World War II to resistance groups all over Europe. And what I found really interesting was the idea of how these messages change, that sometimes they were coded messages. Sometimes they were language, you know, sometimes they were Morse code, but they always went through this transformation. So it's funny, as I listen to the piece in rehearsal, there can be a very limited amount of material in the piece. There are some melodies that repeat many, many times, but the idea is they keep being changed a little bit, just like a process of encryption. Yeah, radio's always been important to me. I love old vinyl, but you know, that's a different kind of distortion. And people would mix the record, adding in more highs, and you know, sometimes with weird stereo imaging, just to make up for the process of, you know, how it would sound on the radio, how it would sound on the turntable. So it's not like that was perfect either, but I like some element of analog in there, but I would not overly romanticize the quality of vinyl because it had its problems too, storage being one of them. I don't work that much with stereo imaging. I think that's something that people do a lot, again, in Super Collider and in Max. And for me, it can be a little bit of a cliche now, certain types of imaging. So, you know, usually I go high tech enough to have something be in stereo. Now that there, you know, memory is no longer at a premium. But I remember when I first got my hardware sampler, you would sample things in mono and just, you know, place the samples across a stereo field because storage was at such a premium. this sounds like a simplified answer, but the important thing is the sound of it, I'd say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm really connected with how things sound. I prefer music usually that doesn't have a visual attached. I mean, I think when you write music for dance, it's in the service of the performance and it's secondary. I think a lot of work that's for music and video, the music winds up being secondary to the video. And I think something that's really exciting is watching people perform music. You know, I think actually watching the musicians is really fun, and you learn something that you don't learn from just listening to a recording, you know? Classical music has to be really doctored for recordings, because the quiet stuff is really quiet. And in live performance, I remember discussing this with a mastering engineer, you have this visual component of the person playing, so you know what's going on. You know, you see the violinist slowly dragging the bow, but if it's on a CD and it's in the same frequency as the lights that are buzzing, you don't know what the hell's going on. Yesterday, rehearsing one piece after the other, we were like, God, we're playing really quiet in this piece, which is appropriate. You know, it's kind of spooky and ambient and evocative. But then here come the drums. It's important to have an unusual title, especially in this age of Googling. So I'm always careful to have something that's unique. I mean, I'll actually Google a title before I choose it to make sure it's not, you know, sometimes it happens. My friend Roger Clyer named a piece Hammerhead, and then he saw that that was a piece on a new Jeff Beck album. He's like, oops, time to change the name. I like evoking the idea of what the piece might sound like. I guess I've come a long way from being in punk bands. One of the most important musical experiences was playing in, not necessarily in punk bands, but in punk clubs in Southern California, where just there's all kinds of new stuff going on. And playing in bands, it was never enough of one thing to call it a punk band. You know, it was always kind of our own approach to it, but that could be part of the reason why I'm drawn to loud drums too, and rhythmic ideas. It's funny, a lot of the music I listen to is like 50s R&B and soul music from the 60s and 70s, and that never really stopped. It's my secret influence. And it's nice to listen to something that's very different than what you do, I think. Grandparents, half of them came into New York, and my grandmother worked, you know, 12, 13 years old in a factory. And then I come and move to the same neighborhood, you know, decades and decades later, and it's all gentrified and hip, and it's where the artists live, and it's such a funny part of personal history. Yeah.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.